In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. More than 20,000 military personnel are posted in and around Washington, D.C. in the wake of the destruction at the January 6th rally. On-the-ground reports and photos now show the invasion of the Capitol building to be staged, a flag that is false, while a stolen presidential election was certified. We have entered a darker moment, and not surprisingly, considering the relentless, irrational attacks against the Trump administration by the corporate press and establishment. No living human has ever seen this before. Imagine the cost of keeping it in the news cycle, let alone the collective psychological damage. It's certain that protections on free speech have deeply eroded. On the bright side, more people in this country now know the true, diabolical nature of the corporate press and the origins of their message. There's a strange quietness right now, and it suggests there's a lot going on behind the scenes. We're joined by returning guest Charles Ortel to discuss a range of current issues, including the swift deterioration of civil liberties under the pretense of making you safe. Charles is a private investor, writer, and analyst who examines world financial markets, geopolitical developments, with a focus on exposing fraud and corruption. In 2015, he started investigations into charities, especially those appearing to operate illegally to create wealth and extend political power for their trustees, executives, and selected donors. Charles, welcome back to Another News.
Well, it's very great to be with you, Jeff.
As listeners may know, you and Jason Goodman of Crowdsource the Truth collaborate on two weekly live streams, Closing In and Sunday with Charles. Both shows are on point, and Jason is one of the top producers out there right now with an impressive art department. The Sunday with Charles show is where you both walk through the streets of Manhattan live streamed on YouTube, discussing your investigative work into charities and current events. You were at the D.C. rally on January 6th with Jason. Would you give listeners your impression being around Trump supporters and a general perspective of the event?
Sure. We got down to Washington, D.C. on the 5th in the evening and actually just stayed inside our hotel, didn't go out at all that night. Got up pretty early and went down to the Ellipse, which is walking distance from where we were staying, not far from the White House. And it was a festive environment. People were from all over America dressed in the equivalent of ugly Christmas sweaters or, you know, Trump sweaters and Trump decals and Trump hats. And the Trump supporters were very jovial, friendly, oftentimes, I would say, on the older side, and oftentimes groups of mothers and fathers and grandfathers and sometimes kids and whatever. In order to go to the main portion where everyone was gathered, we would have had to stand in line from 6 o'clock in the morning or earlier. And that was very cold, actually, and windy. So we decided we wouldn't go into the lowest ground closest to where the president ultimately spoke. But we were behind that in the spillover section. Now, I'm no expert on crowds, but in the morning I turned on something through channels, and, of course, I ended up on NBC, which I don't like to watch. Some idiot announcer was saying, well, we hear that our people on the ground say that there are 5,000 disgruntled Trump supporters waiting to hear him speak. And I could tell you, I don't know whether it was a million, half a million, or a million and a half, but in no way was it 5,000. It was a gigantic crowd of people who brought in the main, they had paraphernalia, they had American flags, they had Don't Tread on Me flags. Some people unwisely had a Confederate flag or two. But in the main, these were the kind of people you would see at Tea Party rallies. Interspersed amongst those were younger people who seemed out of place. They were more physically fit. Many of them were wearing masks outdoors. There's no real need to wear a mask outdoors, and they were wearing masks. Some of them had what looked like camouflage outfits on, and there had been warnings that there would be Antifa, BLM, even Proud Boy infiltrators trying to hijack the crowd, as ultimately later did happen. So We walked all around. Jason has put up two editions of what we did. One is a two and a half hour edition, which takes selected cuts from the longer 4-hour and 57-minute version, both of which are out there still for the moment on Jason Goodman's channels, which are Jason Goodman on YouTube and then Crowdsource the Tooth 2 and 3. When you're doing them, when you're walking around, I personally was concerned about the strenuousness of it because it's really, it was cold. We were walking up and downhill. I was concerned about being maybe hit by somebody if there was a nasty person there. So I was constantly looking around and certainly did not look at a single comment while I was doing it. But I think so long as the videos are up there, people who want to get one view of what was happening will be well able to see the kind of granular detail that we saw. So we were in the back. The sound, it was interesting, was terrible of the system that was used for the various people speaking. Some of the speakers came off, like Kimberly Guilfoyle, who I think had a problem at one of the conventions speaking too loudly, came off like she was screaming. She was in an all-black outfit, it seemed, and she seemed like she was she wasn't wearing a witch hat, but it seemed like she was screaming and hectoring the crowd. And by the time Donald Trump got up to speak, the sound wasn't very good for him. So we strained to hear him. And I don't know if it was audio problem or we were just so far away from the stage and the spillover area. We reached a decision after a while that when we heard him say, "I'm with you. We are now going to walk over to the Capitol. I want you to do it patriotically, and I want you to do it lawfully and peacefully." What went right into my mind was an episode of The West Wing. Now, The West Wing is a TV series that is maddening because the basic premise is always that all Republicans are evil and then only the noble progressives and liberals sacrifice for the better good of the country. But having said all that, there's not that much good stuff on to watch anyway. It's pretty well, it's a gripping thing. And there's a famous episode where the president, who I think is played by Martin Sheen, and he is, I would say, in the series, a decent guy on balance, who does decide to break a logjam in negotiations with Congress to do exactly the walk that President Trump was talking from the White House, down the Ellipse, down the Mall, over to Capitol Hill with no appointment. So I immediately, when he said that, I thought, wow, this is kind of bold. You know, is he drawing off that television moment, which liberals and progressives at the time, when they watched that, celebrate, oh, this is so novel, it's fantastic that a president would do this. So we were pretty far away and then closer to the Capitol than anybody close to Trump speaking was. And we thought, why don't we get there early? Why don't we leave now? Let's not wait for him to finish the speech. And so we were sort of pioneering a little bit. And it's a long walk. I mean, I don't know how long it is in distance, but I would say if you walk at a normal pace of 3 miles an hour, it should probably take you at least 45 minutes, if not longer. And as I say, we left before he finished the speech. By the time we got there, there was no barrier to going onto the Capitol grounds. Now, I don't like Washington, D.C., so I go there very infrequently. Every time I go there, it reminds me of all the money they're burning and that my children and grandchildren eventually will have to pay. So I go there as infrequently as possible. But every time I have been there, there's always security. In fact, we got by the Commerce Department. Now, the Commerce Department is not a place that I can see radicals going to try to overpower. But in front of the Commerce Department, and interestingly, I noticed it said entrance 12 in the Commerce Department. Now, why it needs 12 entrances is another question. Why we need a Commerce Department is another question. There were two Secret Service guys with automatic weapons standing there guarding the Commerce Department, or one of the entrances of the Commerce Department, before Trump spoke. And by the time we get to the Capitol, where, you know, it's no surprise that there was a throng of people heading towards Washington, D.C. Trump mentioned it many times. He said it was going to be a wild thing. He encouraged his people to go. There was a lot of chatter in the public domain. They should have expected a crowd. When we got to the Capitol, there were temporary security fences, but they'd been breached. And there was no sign saying keep off the grounds. There was no police presence. There were no National Guards. There were no vehicles. There was nothing. Instead, there was a festive group of these Trump people who went up onto the ground. So we decided, having gotten there early, that for the benefit of our viewers, we wanted to go onto the grounds. Didn't say you couldn't. And but we didn't get close to the throng that was up on the base stage, or maybe the portion of the Capitol. There were temporary stands set up already for the inauguration, which will take place this coming Wednesday. But there are a lot of people who had thronged up on there, and we saw no signs of any police up in the immediate area. And after a while, I said to Jason, it's on air, I believe I said to him, look, let's get down off of here, and let's go back out on the outside of the grounds, and let's film from there. So for the bulk of the filming, I'd say several hours of that, we filmed from there. And that's when we began to notice anomalies. We began to notice young kids. I call them scruffies if they're men. They've never met a Gillette razor in their lives, so they have these scruffy beards, and some of them were wearing masks, some not. They were wearing camouflage pants. They were wearing the same sort of shoes. They had backpacks on. Some of them had walkie-talkies, and they did not look to me like Secret Service people or whatever. They looked like they were agent provocateur types. And so we saw the mass of these people streaming in, Tea Party type, patriot types streaming in with their people looking. And then we began to see the younger people kind of jump into the crowd, go right to the front of the crowd, and then climb up on these things. And when you look and see the video, it was not a trivial exercise. I mean, I'm 65, and I'm not about to take a crazy risk like that. I don't know how tall the structure was that these people were climbing up. There was a structure in the center that I think was meant to hold television cameras. And then there were two seating areas that were set up. But it was a straight-up climb. And to do that, you've got to have pretty strong upper body strength, and you've got to have the confidence that you can make it up rung to rung. And these people were going up like monkeys. I mean, they were in good shape. They got to the top. And we had... Far away, we had a guy standing next to us who claimed to be a security guard. Now, I'm no expert on security, but my background is in corporate takeovers and leveraged buyouts and business contests. But when you're trying to manage something, a crowd of people, you don't let the crowd get out of control. And what was really odd here, that we had all these House people and all these senators and Mike Pence himself inside the chamber. This is a scheduled, historic event. You would have thought that people would say, now, wait a minute, we can't let a million people stream onto the Capitol grounds. We better make sure that we nip it in the bud. And if some people happen to get in, let's send shock troops in there to at least push them back. And in the beginning, we got there probably 1 o'clock. Well, the tape will tell if people look at 1:30, somewhere in there. And it would have been possible. I remarked to the guard, why aren't they sending reinforcements in? And at some point, cops did come, but they were like bicycle cops, and they weren't going to stop however many tens of thousands of people were already there. On the question of who, what sorts of people were there, I think you could, the ones who stood out, and we would point them out, were anomalous. If you saw the standard color for the Trump supporter was red, and a lot of the people had banners around them and gear, MAGA hats and stuff like that. But then you would see groups of 3 and 4 young kids wearing military sweaters and camouflage and the same boots and the backpacks for a change of clothes. And they would be talking to themselves. Indeed, Jason and I tried to talk to a few of them. They ignored us. And then they melted into the crowd. And it would seem some of them went up to the top. And I think there were mixtures. I believe there's security experts talking in recent days about the tactics that were used there are similar to the tactics seen in Hong Kong by the people who were trying to protest the Chinese government. I think there's a manual that goes through how you do this. But what they were trying to do, an Antifa manual, they would exhort. There were people who would exhort, come to the front, come to the front, and try to push people to come to the front. Go to the top. We come this far. This is our house. Let's burn it down. The common phrases people were saying. And I don't think, having been to many events, I don't think that's the typical Trump supporter. I mean, the events that I've witnessed, the many rallies, I've been to in New York, I've been to numerous BLM rallies. I went out with Jason. We went out to Staten Island to rallies there that I would say are more pro-Trump, over that alehouse thing. But in every single BLM rally, I noticed there were always younger people. Typically, there were younger people with the backpack and typically with a megaphone, electronic megaphone or electric, whatever it is. There were also older people, you know, 65, 70-year-old radical types with either, if they're men, long hair, beard, stuff like that. And they seemed to be working and manipulating the younger crowd. For example, I don't remember the date, we had the BLM rally at Columbus Circle where Hawk Newsom, who is the BLM, supposedly affiliated with BLM here in New York, gets up on stage with his girlfriend who was running for Congress, and the two of them said, "We're not just interested in reforming America. We're interested in burning the, I won't use the phrase, down." And it was really violent rhetoric, and people would come to up to Jason because they'd recognize him or me and start threatening us. I've never seen any of that in the many, many Trump rallies that I've watched on television. I've never been to a Trump rally, but it's never like that. So the notion that we should rush to say that Donald Trump incited what happened, him personally incited what happened by his incendiary rhetoric that occurred before people had arrived at Capitol Hill and were already breaching the grounds and eventually doing what I think is laughable when you contrast it with the actual rhetoric that is still being used to be on. Last night, I won't disclose exactly where I live, but last night I lived near where there was a BLM rally. And it was, you know, violent talk. I could hear it from my apartment building. And hopefully nothing bad happened after the rally. But very frequently in the period March to the present, there in these various demonstrations, there's been a lot of damage to the country in Portland, Seattle, and New York, et cetera. And what I said on air, and I'll say now, we really don't know the facts. Videos are coming in from different angles. We don't. It is as possible that there was a disgruntled Trump person who got out of control and threw a punch. That's possible. But the idea that this was a conspiracy to go in and take hostages and change the results of the election and all personally directed by Trump, and for that he should be impeached with no real due process, as we saw this week, is absurd. It's really what the people who have pushed impeachment on this country, in my view, have done is they have weakened the negative aspects of what impeachment really should be. It should be for high crimes and misdemeanors. It should be a serious thing. And now it's a traffic ticket, in my view. It's not, you can't take this stuff seriously. It's almost a badge of honor. In fact, there's a very funny Babylon Bee. I don't know if you ever see them. It's an internet site. And they're saying Donald Trump is well on his way now to getting a free Subway sandwich because he's been impeached twice. If he gets impeached one more time, he'll get a free sub.
I don't know if you know this, but some of the agent provocateurs are being arrested as well that were involved in the Capitol building rallies. And they were essentially posing as Trump supporters. That's a step in the right direction. But even if this information gets out to people, will it have an impact?
I don't know is the answer. I mean, we look at the system of justice, injustice in this country. My personal efforts since I retired from banking in 2002, getting back into life in 2007, I've been an anti-fraud person. I've been exposing big corporate frauds, Clinton Foundation frauds. And we've now done, I think this Sunday we will have done 300 videos, two-hour videos, exposing fraud, Jason and I, particularly focused on the Clinton Foundation, but also the Obama Foundation, the Bush Foundations, McCain Foundation, you name it. And you would think that the FBI would say after a time, you know, this guy, I mean, he's either just a crotchety dude, but he's really hell-bent or leather to expose us. Maybe we should go send somebody to talk to him. The only time they came to talk to me was in December of 2018, shortly before my ex-wife actually died. The day I found out she was going to die imminently, one of the next calls was from the FBI saying, "Hey, are you Charles Ortelli? Yeah. We want to come meet with you now." I said, "Oh, okay." And it was to investigate my relationship to a man named Peter Smith, who I was one of the last people to speak to him before he was found dead in Minnesota. He was the guy that was trying to get Hillary Clinton's missing emails. And for that, they came rushing into me. And somehow the fact that they were doing that became known to all the mainstream media at the same time. So I was dealing with CNN, MS, all these people contacted me at the same time. They were interested in the theory that I was the money guy behind Peter Smith and that I had traveled over to meet with Julian Assange. Now, fortunately, I always carry my passport in my pocket, and I just took it out. I said, "Listen, here's my passport," and that particular passport. "The last time I left this country was June 12th, June of 2012. because I was in India on a business trip, and I learned that my ex-wife was sick, and I had to come back. And then she got cancer, and I've never left the country since then. You can look at my – here it is. And I only have one passport. That kind of deflated the FBI. But the point is that we seem to have – if you go through the Russian hoax, and then you look at the Ukraine hoax, and now you look at this Capitol riot hoax, in my view – We have a narrative that the mainstream media wants to sell. And the mainstream media is pro-globalism, pro-unregulated globalism, pro-big oligarch. They want to be in the Chinese market, the mainstream media. They have to be because it's a gigantic market. They want the advertising. They like the idea of traveling around the world to all these different countries and conferences. And they don't like Donald Trump's program, which is pro-nationalism, not white supremacist nationalism. No, take what's best of every country, just as we do in the Olympics, and say, you know, let every country send its best set of principles and ideals. Let's compete in the marketplace of ideas, but let's not think that a global government structure can work if there's such large differences in the infrastructure between the United States and European nations and Japan. I frequently cite, when thinking about the World Health Organization, which is a disaster, there are more Ethiopian or doctors of Ethiopian descent in Chicago than there are in the whole country of Ethiopia. And why is that? Because in Ethiopia, there are no good roads. 70% of the population in Ethiopia doesn't have electricity. There's no clean water. There's no clean sanitation. Unlike the United States, where 80%+ are in cities, in Ethiopia it's like 30% are in cities, so people are scattered to the wind. There are no doctors, hospitals. How is somebody who comes out of the health profession in a country that's a disaster today, how do we decide to make that person in charge of the World Health Organization? And by the way, he doesn't have a medical degree. And by the way, he's also a dedicated communist in love with communist China. I mean, this doesn't make any sense to me. And you have to look at the facts that are out there. We may not like the CIA, but the CIA has a world handbook, which every year updates statistics for every country in the world, and you can look through it. It's online, and you can compare these things. You know, miles of paved road, doctors per 100,000 people. There are all these different statistics. You can look at them, and all these globalist plans to make health care better, but still there are no hospitals and no doctors want to work in the country, and there are no nurses. And by the way, you don't have any electricity to run refrigeration equipment to keep the medicine from not being spoiled, and you don't have the ability to check in on these people. You don't know whether somebody who presents with something that could be HIV or even AIDS doesn't have another problem. Same with COVID. You just don't know because there's no way of reaching the people. And so these grand globalism plans, they make sense for McKinsey and consulting firms, investment banks, and rich folks. They don't make sense yet for the national structures that have to implement these lofty goals. And then you get to this whole idea, and I'm on a tear on healthcare here, but I went back and looked for the work I'm doing, which in attacking the Clinton Foundation and their HIV/AIDS work, which is a disaster. They have no right to do what they're doing lawfully. That what they've done is damaged the living conditions and healthcare conditions around the world. And you get into the details, in my experience of the healthcare profession, experienced nurses are the ones who really are very well able to deal with patients. The hotshot doctors, very often, they're not the ones who their minds are in thinking about Nobel Prizes and honors and stuff like that. But it's the nurses who day to day deal with the patients and, you know, help you get the right care. And I'd like to see a much lower relationship administrators to those nurses and doctors than we have. You take Chelsea Clinton as a case in point. Her books are laughably insane. You go into some of the stuff that she's written about extolling the Global Fund, which experts I've talked to say that 75% of all the money that went into the Global Fund has been stolen. Credible reports of this. Inside People, Inspector General reports. She extols it. She writes a PhD thesis, a master's thesis and a PhD thesis on how great the Global Fund is when it's a disaster. And you go back and you look at the stats. Harvard and Yale and Columbia, these top medical schools, they mint a very small percentage, a number of doctors. I want to say that Some of these schools is like 200 new doctors a year or 300 doctors a year. It's not thousands. Yet the same places will mint gigantic numbers of masters in public health and doctors, people who can write essays to one another about how you should do this and how you should do that. That's all fine and dandy. Let's treat the patients. Let's make sure there's some infrastructure. Let's see that there's some context to all that. And so I think around the world, people who were frustrated with the Obama 8 years and elected Trump, and then were happy with Trump in what he was doing to try to jumpstart the economy, decrease the bureaucracy, increase living standards and income levels for minorities and for women and for others. And when we look at what he actually did pre-COVID, it was very, very fantastic, frankly, compared to recent history. Even go back to Reagan, probably better than Reagan. In what he managed to do. Reagan took over from an ineffectual President Carter. He had his issues, but it took him a good 2 years to get things moving. In his first 3 years as president, this guy got a hell of a lot done. And it's natural that his supporters would look at where we are, look at the known facts and say, you know, this something isn't right here. And so I think actually to see how tame the reaction was in Washington, D.C., compared to what I witnessed in the BLM rallies. I mean, this was not setting up a chop in Washington, D.C., or for that matter, what I've seen here in New York. You know, when they tried to set up a chop down there in around City Hall, we went and looked at that. And it's sad that the country is in the position it's in now. But I think we need to take our time and not rush to judgment as people did. I mean, people were ready to impeach Trump just the same way this lunatic Republican woman is now introducing impeachment articles against Biden. He isn't even president yet. She's trying to do that. I mean, we need to go back to base principles and remember that we may disagree politically on certain issues, but we're all in one country fighting a common enemy. And that enemy actually is the Communist Party of China. It's not.
As you may know, the group Stop the Steal was banned from Facebook last November, but now simply contesting the legitimacy of the election is considered threatening. Some people who don't like President Trump may not fully grasp what's happening, but it's not good for anyone in this country. There was a massive election theft on a scale beyond what anyone has seen. Yet, you now can't mention it on social media without being censored or banned. We're now not allowed to disagree with the political party narratives or ask questions. You've been talking about this on the show. Please share your thoughts with the listeners.
Sure. So social media was originally Facebook. I'm thinking about Twitter. To a lesser extent, you could say Google social media too. But it was sold to us as a gift that the use of it's free and you should be grateful for this and aren't we noble and don't look too closely at how much money we're going to make off you. We're never going to use this to silence freedom of expression or to pitch one party or one point of view or one political position or another. It was supposed to be a platform, Facebook and Twitter. And instead, it has made people like Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg multi-billionaires. Like anything else, when I think about a problem like this that I think is a business problem, not a political problem, I go back to base principles. Michael Bloomberg, when he was mayor of New York, he forced on us this idea that every restaurant had to tell you the caloric count of anything that you were buying so that you could make an educated decision. Did you want to spend the money and, you know, consume so many calories in the day? I forget what the normal caloric intake is, but whatever it is. I thought that was a bit overboard, but I think the terms of service of Facebook and the terms of service of Google and others are so one-sided and fail to make material disclosures about how much money you are making for the providers, for the platforms, by participating, by using the service. In other words, I think before you sign up for a Facebook or a Twitter or a Google, you should be told that, and let's take Google, for every time you enter a search question, the presumption is you're interested in that. You wouldn't be searching if you didn't have some sort of interest. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep track of your interests and we're going to build a profile of you. And we're going to have, when you ask these questions, over time, once we get to a critical number, whether it's 100 searches, 1,000, whatever the number is, we will then be able, by comparing your search interests at the time of day, we'll be able to figure out your age, your gender, whatever. And we are going to build up a picture of you that will be enormously valuable to people who are trying to sell you Coke versus Pepsi, Miller versus Budweiser, this kind of car versus some others. And it's going to be enormously valuable to the advertisers that are going to then pay us to have an interface with you so that when your search results come up, there'll be an ad for Coke if we determine that you like Coke or Pepsi or whatever. And the monetization of your time is going to work as follows. For every hour that you spend searching, it is likely that we're going to generate, pick a number, in ad revenue. And you shouldn't understand that, yes, it's free what you're doing. It doesn't cost you anything to search. But we are monetizing. We are making a cash return off of your time. And beyond that, it'll become a public company. So the advertising revenue that you're generating and the profits that you're generating, because the financial markets are wild, are going to create a gigantic increase in the value of the oligarchs' stock holdings and the funds that are big investors in the Facebook and the individuals in the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Googles, et cetera. There should be much more of an explanation of that. It is not really free. It's almost like a drug dealer approach that we're going to give you, we're going to hook you on cocaine and give you a few hits at first, and then you're going to sell everything you had and live in the gutter, addicting yourself to once we've addicted you with this free stuff. There needs to be, I think, a much better understanding of the has-gets relationship. I had a mentor in finance who would describe every merger as you has and you gets, what you has and what you gets as a result of the merger. So you have your free time, and you don't have to use it on searching. You could use it inventing something for yourself or running your own business. Now you're giving Google an hour of your free time every day, and yes, you're getting some benefit, but how much are they getting off you, and how much is Twitter getting off you? And then you start thinking about the evils of these places. Early motto of Google was, don't do evil. Now, there was a doctor a psychiatrist or psychologist, whose name was Epstein, I believe, who alleged that, and I think his wife had something to do with it, that a large number of votes were switched in the 2016 election from Trump to Clinton by the way in which search results turned out. So if you have you search on Hillary Clinton and up comes Joan of Arc, Nobel Prize candidate, could invent cancer if she had more time, you know, and then you punch in Donald Trump and it's devil incarnate, Satan is nicer, and whatever. You can obviously change the way in which the surface level thinkers will think about Hillary and Trump. And to the extent you're involved and you don't have any benefits that are special benefits, maybe that's okay. But Google and Twitter and Facebook are protected. They're not deemed to be publishers, right? So they have this Section 230 protection. They can't easily be sued for the content.
For banning people.
And they have the flexibility to ban people and stuff like that. And all of that needs to be rethought. Will it be rethought? Of course not, because who are the biggest contributors to the political parties, either directly or indirectly?
And who is benefiting?
Right, and who's benefiting from it? It's the social media companies, it's the established media companies, it's academia. And so we've allowed these tools to get to a place where they're not tools, they're enslaving us.
Telling you what you can say or can't say.
Right.
Or investigate and ask questions. It's interesting because the left has embraced these oppressive measures when normally it would be seen as discrimination.
Yeah, it really is ironic. I mean, the crowd that's really running the hippy-dippy revolution today and the intolerant counter-Trump revolution is the same crowd who back in the 60s said, don't trust anybody over 30. These people are 75, 80 years old today. And back then, they wanted the establishment Republican country club types who ran things to allow every lunatic idea that they had to be given equal weighting or at least consideration, fair consideration. they wanted to crack the status quo and mold its society in a different way, which is fine. But today, after 50 years later, whatever the math is, to have these very same people who evidently have learned little, but in some cases, like the Clintons, have stolen much, to now move towards a zone where there's only one answer. And the answer is Trump is a bad orange man, and conservatives are evil, and socialism is wonderful, and history is – America's a horrible place because of our history.
No questions.
It used to be question authority. That was a hallmark. When I was a young teenager or whatever, I had a button collection. Those buttons that you could buy, and I grew up in Greenwich Village. And I remember there were a bunch of these hippy-dippy buttons, question authority, et cetera, et cetera. Frankly, I think that questioning authority will always push the frontiers of knowledge forward. And embracing the idea that you shouldn't think for yourself, you shouldn't look at evidence, that evidence doesn't matter, let's just rush off in one direction, is lemming behavior. And I'm told that lemmings actually are mischaracterized as well in life. But it's the behavior that lets you get that congressman, was it Jim Jones, who took everybody down to Guyana and a whole bunch of people were killed, drinking Kool-Aid. The last thing we want to do in 2021, with all of the tools that we now have, this program will beam around to many, many places. It wasn't so easy to do this 10, 12 years ago, 20 years ago. The stuff that Jason and I do was basically impossible to do 5-10 years ago, just with little cell phone cameras and stuff. And so we have the ability to share knowledge, to ask questions of one another in these group forums. We should be doing that. Founders, and indeed one of the smartest founders, he's a controversial guy, but Thomas Jefferson, when you get into his writings, he authored the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, which is one of the most important documents, I would argue, in American history, that then gave rise to this idea in our Constitution, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, et cetera. The idea back then, in 1776 or thereabouts, was they had experience with repressive popular uprising regimes under Cromwell in England. They had authoritarian kings who just decided that you had to live under their thumb and thought nothing of hanging, drawing, and quartering people, the political enemies for minor offenses, thought nothing of making it impossible for a political enemy's children to actually ever function in life by stripping them of the right to inherit or own property. So they'd been through these cruel periods. And they felt, and Jefferson in particular felt, he writes about it, it's far better to let a controversial topic be discussed. And then if it's really noxious or horrible, odious, to have the people who listen to it say, no, you're wrong for this reason and that, than it is to stifle all dissent. Because, frankly, there isn't a person on the planet smart enough to tell all of us how to live our lives. No one could figure out the vagaries of 7.5 billion different people and what their different ailments and interests and strengths and weaknesses might be. And far better to let each of us function first ourselves and then a family and a community and then a smaller government, national government focus, rather than letting the schemers gather at Davos and decide how they're going to reset the global economy and tell each of us to live. So we're at a very interesting moment here where a small number of people, I look at Jack Dorsey, and I don't want to pick on him for his appearance, but I call him Osama bin Dorsey. He looks like Osama bin Laden, frankly, with a crazy beard. And his ideas, what are his qualifications to tell me, that I missed something or I was wrong, having been in Washington, D.C. for that rally?
You're right. What qualifications do these CEOs of social media have to tell you how to think and how to formulate an opinion and whether or not you can investigate or ask a question of, extremely controversial issues, especially the election theft, which has documented evidence and thousands of affidavits? It's unbelievable what has happened and how that quickly certified. People are very upset about this. I think that's probably why a lot of people went to Washington, D.C., aside from the lockdowns and the irrational reasons for the lockdowns. It's unbelievable what has occurred.
If you think about it, I would actually place some of the blame for where we are today on Jack Welch and the cult of personality that he created. He was the legendary CEO that grew GE, General Electric, from 1981 to 2001 when he left, creating a billion-dollar fortune for himself. And around him, there emerged this culture where if you're rich, you must know more than a poor person. And in my lifetime, many of the smartest people I know are don't care about money and are poor. And I think I would imagine a truly progressive movement would say, if you're rich, you're not necessarily correct in your thinking. It's just that you know how to make money. If you're poor, you're not necessarily incorrect in your thinking. You just have decided you don't want to chase money, or you want to live frugally, or you know, you want to live on the street. Doesn't mean that your ideas are smarter or worse. And what has emerged is this culture where we pay tribute to billionaires like Bill Gates. We don't ask deep enough questions about, you know, just exactly how did Bill Gates create his multi-billion-dollar fortune? Was he running a monopoly? Is he running still or participating in anti-competitive monopolistic practices in the way that he runs his life? Certainly the Google people and Facebook people and Bezos and Amazon and others like and Twitter, are they running monopolies and benefiting from monopolies? And at a time where you have Donald Trump standing up to a country, China, that is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army, a place where 10% of the population or thereabouts is in the Communist Party, the other 90% is not, a place where Muslim minority Uyghurs are in concentration camps, a place where working conditions in some of these sub-component places are horrific. You have nets at Foxconn to try to keep people from committing suicide, jumping out over the poor labor conditions. You would think that these virtue signalers in Silicon Valley would be up in arms at trying to do business with a country as it is currently controlled by the CCP, and in fact would be all in for Steve Bannon, you know, in his effort with a war room pandemic, which I've been watching recently. He is single-handedly taking on the CCP and the injustices, and you would think there's much more common cause between Trump on his China position than there evidently is with all the folks at Twitter and Facebook and elsewhere trying to get Trump rushed out of office and, worse than that, canceled.
And it suggests that they're in on bringing those systems into the United States and into the fabric of this society. And I also think about the Trump supporters actually have a lot in common with disenfranchised, impoverished people in this country. And there could be a lot of similar ground, but the systems to divide people right now are so powerful. And a lot of it's coming from the corporate press. And then if that doesn't work to get proper information into the hands of people, then outright censorship. And it seems that, well, there's an example. Andy Ngo's book, Exposing Antifa, was banned from a bookstore in Oregon after protesters demanded it to be removed.
It's outrageous. I mean, when you go back through history and you think, for example, of Galileo and the way Galileo was persecuted, and it took centuries for the Catholic Church to apologize to his descendants or whatever. But what you find at the frontiers of knowledge, not that I'm at the frontiers of knowledge, but my father is a PhD in nuclear physics and studied it with Niels Bohr and a postdoc after Yale. And so I've been raised by a very smart man who's still alive, and my mom has passed away, but she was an expert on Johann Sebastian Bach. So I've been around people who are thinkers and maybe at the forefront of what they were trying to do. Being at the forefront, being a pioneer, is an uncomfortable place to be. You're taking on the status quo. You're trying to look at things slightly differently. We should be encouraging responsible pioneers. We should not be encouraging hot-headed AOC bartender, former bartenders, who've decided that they can mix a mean drink and therefore they should be able to burn down the United States of America and force us to spend $100 trillion on some cockamamie plan that she doesn't even understand or can't explain. that's the kind of behavior that you see in junior high school, as Trump accused her of being in high school and maybe in college. You know, you get free from your parents for the first time, and you know, all these revolutionaries out there, and say, I can do this. I'll be a revolutionary. We'll remake America in my image. You know, that's so juvenile, frankly. And it's so disrespectful of the many people who have come before us. There are a lot of people who are still dead and will be dead for eternity who have made enormous contributions to the thinking that could shape each of us. And those people should be studied. I mean, the callousness with which we're now hearing, oh, we can't, you know, all these people who in the past lived in their time and may have had defects but made enormous contributions, we're free today because George Washington was the father of our country. We have a transition in power coming next week because George Washington turned down the chance to be king. Think of that. I mean, how many of the 100 senators, if they were in a similar place, would turn down the chance to be king, or the 435 representatives, or the 50 governors in this country? So the accomplishments and the nature of our past should be studied objectively, not with an eye that, you know, you're a Marxist or you look at it this way or a capitalist this way. Marxism and capitalism had little to do with the early history of this country, based on what I see. And this recent period has been such a disservice, I think. We've really been in a period, I would argue, from 1988 to the present, we've been in a 33-year war against the American worker, where the people who love unregulated globalism have been thriving under it, or billionaires because of it, or more, they are so happy to keep everyone else dependent on government, needing government, not putting their head above the fence to figure out how they can become billionaires, not asking uncomfortable questions of Jeff Bezos, for example, about exactly how does somebody become as rich as he is when Amazon doesn't make that much money when you look at the financial statements the way I do, which is carefully. How is it possible that he's worth all this money? Why is the stock trading where it's trading? Why is it always going up, 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 up? You know, why is he now one of the richest landowners in America? Why does he have multiple jobs all at once? And why are we in a place, because of Amazon in part, that so many mom-and-pop businesses are crushed?
I heard in Canada they're forcing people to order Amazon because of, you know, shutting down the local businesses, and you're going to have to order Amazon. So it's being used as a strategy to weaken economies, just destroy them. Those who support President Trump are removed from social media, banned from certain businesses or banks. People start to vote with their pocketbook. Twitter's stock has dipped since January 6th, which is a sign of what people think about censoring the United States president. What are your thoughts there? And maybe the more long-term response, such as starting your own social media platforms, creating your own bank and currency?
Well, I actually think that this is an opportunity, frankly. I think that I know the three amigos, the Google guy and Zuckerberg and Dorsey, testified before Congress saying that they're nonpartisan, and just they lied their asses off before Congress, in my view. And Dorsey, it was interesting that Dorsey in particular was very much in favor of people being allowed to use alias or fake names on Twitter. I understand why you might want to use a fake name. That's fine. But on these vast social media programs, the platforms, I think you should be forced to use your real name. And I think you should only be able to have one account, your real name. And I think if you had such a platform where, you know, if you want to express your opinion, be person enough. I don't want to use a gender. Be person enough. Give us your true name. Everything that I do is under my real name. And I took on General Electric when I was just me, and they had a market cap of $900 billion, taking on the Clintons. You know, people said you should use an alias. Why would I do that? You know, we're not going to live forever, any of us, and you know, I'm pretty careful, and I'm sure of my ground, and I do my research. I think if you use these social media platforms, you should be forced to use your real name. You should have real terms of service. I read recently, some people told me that the IMF, which should be disbanded, but the International Monetary Fund is proposing an idea that in determining credit scores, you should have to look through your internet search history. That's preposterous. Your internet search history has nothing to do with, in my view, with whether you're a credit-worthy customer. What the things that matter are your income, your spending pattern, your taxes, your history of paying them or not paying them, and your assets and your liabilities. That's what matters. What you choose to look for in a search engine, it's ridiculous. And the chilling nature that that would then place on your search activity, if you knew, well, if I search for this, you know, maybe I won't be able to get a mortgage, or maybe the mortgage I have gotten from a bank, I'll get a letter saying, well, we just learned you were looking at nationalist ideas or looking at Donald Trump, so we're not going to raise your interest rate. I mean, the potential for turning a free and open society into a totalitarian despotism is, I think, very high there. And I would hope that people across the political spectrum would say, this is yet another cockamamie idea out of Silicon Valley.
Do you think, as people are banned for their ideas and political affiliations, that there will be a stronger separation occurring to the point where people start to create their own social medias and banks, separating almost to the point of secession?
In New York is one example, a city I've lived in off and on since 1959. This is a city run by an idiot, overseen by an idiot overlord in de Blasio and Cuomo. These people, their key values of those two gentlemen is whatever they decide to do is absolutely the wrong thing to do, and you should do the opposite of what they recommend. That's very valuable when somebody's always wrong, because you can know how to. And a city and a state like New York are doomed, frankly. I'm sorry to say that, but there's too much debt. There actual financial debt. There's too. The pension obligations of the city are massive. The city and state have fundamentally anti-business attitudes, anti-constitution, anti-law, fair administration of law. And any sensible person who can leave the city or state will, with money. It's just you're a fool to stay in the city, because for at least 4 years anyway under Biden, and I guess the people who are going to replace de Blasio are probably even worse than he is, and Cuomo. If you're making a long-lived decision to invest money, let's say in a real estate project or an industry project, you're a fool to keep your money here. You may as well put your money in Somalia, because you'll have at least, you know, in Somalia, on the way over there, you can stop in Dubai and you can have a nice meal or whatever. In New York, you're not going to make any money. You're going to lose money. You're going to be taxed. You're going to be demonized in this city. So I think you are going to see people, and you're already seeing people, rushing out of the city and state to places they think might be more hospitable, like Texas or Florida or Wyoming or something like that, or even to leave the country. And that's a sad thing to see. But I think that is, as you age, you know, you have to make decisions. You have to say, look, how many more years do I have on the planet? Do I really want to stay in Dante's Inferno here on the eighth level of hell, hoping that I don't have to go down to the ninth level or that it's not that hot down there? So, yeah, I think you're going to see more fractionalization of the country. I think when I was struck, for example, when Biden was selected, not elected, but selected by the media early on, right after the election, there was a seemingly spontaneous outpouring around the city. I went all over. It didn't seem that spontaneous to me, but there was everybody honking horns. And it struck me, these people who are now so happy Biden won, there were no Biden signs that I saw the way there were Obama signs in 2008. Greenwich Village was plastered. Every townhouse had an Obama placard in every window almost. There's nothing like that for Biden. And suddenly all these people are out in the village hooting horns and skateboards and having good old time. It made me think that certain portions of this country are, you know, in the case of Manhattan, New York County, I think it was something like 95-5 Biden-Trump, right? And there are other portions of the other counties where it might be 85-15 Trump-Biden. And can these two different parts of the country get along? Maybe, but maybe not. The overwhelming by county number of counties were pro-Trump. And you start saying to these pro-Trump counties, we're going to take away your guns. We want you to pay for the sins and wastefulness of our past. We want you to pay our bills. And we want to demonize. You have people in the mainstream media saying anybody who supported Trump is akin to being a Nazi or a KKK or a white supremacist. I mean, I don't see how you bridge those gaps. And especially with our new president deciding that one of his first orders of business is to allow the Senate to preside over an impeachment trial. Frankly, I think I hope he doesn't do that, because it will be an enormous blunder for him and for the country. Yeah, we're headed towards a point where this country is being pushed apart, which is exactly what China wants.
I agree that seems to be the goal, and I hope more people realize that's coming our way.
What does a political party do for you as an individual? If you're in Congress, maybe it makes it easier for you to caucus or this or the other. The reality is most people are not that numerate, and so they don't necessarily get into economics that much and into finance, and they don't necessarily have informed views on how businesses work and how the economy might be better run. But all of us have views shaped by our experience about society and morals and the way we should live and how people should be treated. And when you eliminate the time bomb or the incendiary part of discussion, let's not talk about economics for a second. Let's just talk about censorship. You know, do you believe in censorship? I don't think a single conservative would say, yeah, oh, censorship, that's great. And most progressives would say, yeah, we agree on that. Do you think the United States of America needs 18 intelligence agencies in 2021? And again, I think most conservatives would say, hell no, and most progressives. And you could pick education. Do you think we should have a system where people are force-fed ideas or with limited resources and forced to look at a whole bunch of things that might be completely irrelevant to their later lives? Or do you think early on people should begin to specialize, and if they want to go down the academic track and teach, maybe they have one sort of way they learn. If they want to become a car mechanic, which is not an easy thing to do today, maybe they should go a different track. If they don't want to, if you really started thinking about education as a way of giving people tools to live more productive lives, I think you'd have a lot more common set of interests. And I think out of all this, what we've seen is a destruction of the idea that experts know anything. But when somebody says, are you a this or a that? I'm unclassified. I don't want to be put in a box. You know, I'm me. And I think we got away from this. Well, we can only have a good discussion. You can only come on WBAI if you're a progressive. Frankly, some of the best radio experiences I've had have been on the hard left stations. There's a wonderful woman, Eutrice Lead. I've done many, many shows with her, and where we go all over the map. And, you know, we respect one another and we have disagreements and sometimes we agree, but we have productive discussions. That's what we should have, not necessarily Trump rallies, not necessarily. I mean, I don't think you could characterize what Biden did as rallies. Those were meetings at Jeep warehouses of six people.
I don't think enough people realize how few people show up to those events. It's going to be a very strange time. Charles Ortel, I want to thank you again for being on Another News. It's just great to have you on. I appreciate you just giving your impression and perspective of what's been going on in the last few months. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.